Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. We turn our attention toward the sky once again on this edition of the show. We welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to answer your questions about the stars and the moon and the planets. You know, there's a lot of talk about the supermoon that's coming this month. Yes, we've had a lot of supermoons, and maybe you found them to be underwhelming. But this one, on the other hand, is really something, and Bob will tell you why. So that supermoon, it's like a, you know, it's like a big box store. There's always another one right around the corner. Wow, this is huge, and we'll tell you why. The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here, astronomy on Vox Pop. Oh, it begins after the news. Hello, once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the studio to field all of your astronomy-related questions. Always wanted to know what Bob thinks about being known as renowned. We'll find out in a moment. Bob is one of the best-known, renowned, if you will, most widely read astronomers in the whole wide world. His most recent book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time, Consciousness, and the Illusion of Death. I believe it's out. Is it out on paperback yet? No, it's not yet. Soon. When's the film? Have you optioned it? The number to call with your questions is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program, voxpop@wamc.org. But I recommend, as it is a call-in program, the number 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Well, I mentioned it in the billboard at the top of the hour. The supermoon is coming. Another supermoon. Every other show we talk about a supermoon. But this one, I got a press release from NASA today. This is a big one on November 14th.
This is a big one, yes. I noticed this a few years ago in this technical table of the moon's apogees and perigees every month, and I looked, whoa, November 14th, 2016, that's a really big, close moon. And so this is the real deal.
So supermoons are 10% bigger than average moons in general, or 10, 15% bigger?
8%.
8%.
Yeah.
But this one is, from what I am told, the closest since 1948. So how much bigger?
It is.
Big as a pie in the sky?
No, this is still like 8 or 9%. It's still not big enough so that if you went out and looked at it, you'd say, wow, that moon looks really big. It's still not noticeable to the eye. But on paper or conceptually, yeah, the moon hasn't come this close since 1948. So this full moon will be, at least on paper, the largest full moon since then.
Okay, and not again until 2034 will it be
this
big.
That's
right. So it's the supermoon. And why is it a supermoon again?
Well, the moon has an elliptical orbit, not a round orbit around Earth, so that every month it's going to have some closest point and furthest point. And then, not to mention, the moon's orbit changes shape all the time. So sometimes it gets extremely eccentric or out of round. And then you could say, well, this year, this happens to be the closest full moon, not only of the month, but of the whole year. And you'll have that every year. You'll have some moon that's the closest moon, and the media, for just the last few years, because it's not an astronomical term, supermoon, the media have started calling those supermoons. But here's one that's the closest since 1948. So you got to say, well, this is a little bit less hype than the others.
Yeah.
This is the real deal. Enough so that, for example, Mohonk Mountain House is having a special night of the supermoon next Sunday night to celebrate it and for all the guests to go out and see the supermoon.
Oh, neat.
Yeah.
So that's great. So now, of course, we'll have clouds and rain here. But if we didn't, what would be the best time to see that supermoon?
All night long. Well, the best time really is when it's first rising at around sunset, because the moon undergoes a second and even more significant expansion of its apparent size, and that's called the moon illusion. The moon illusion just happens when anything, not just the moon, but a constellation, Orion or the Big Dipper, anything when it's low looks bigger than at other times.
Right, and that is purely illusion.
It's illusion because you're then seeing it next to earthly objects. And compared to the vast expanse of the sky, the 180 degrees of the hemisphere of the sky, which will dwarf a constellation and really dwarf the moon, which is only half a degree wide, If it's against like distant trees or distant houses or church steeples or what have you, that gives it some size.
Yeah.
And so we look at that, and now the moon looks really big when it's low, when it's first rising.
So the moon on average is 250,000 miles away?
Yeah, that's pretty close, 232,000, 234,000. And it depends on whether we're talking center to center, which is what astrophysicists use, or surface to surface, which is what you actually see. Obviously, when we look at the moon, we're seeing its surface. We're not seeing its center.
Mm-hmm.
So although the media are saying this moon will be 221,000 miles away, I would prefer to say, well, I think you have to subtract our own radius of 4,000 miles plus the moon's radius of another 1,000 miles and deduct 5,000 miles from that 221,000 and say, more honestly, it's 216,000 miles its surface from us, and that's pretty darn close. It's close enough so that if you use just a 100-power telescope, it's going to look as if it's just one moon width away from you.
Ooh. Well, that'll be exciting.
Yeah.
I will try that old telescope this time and hope I can find the actual moon up in the sky. The last time it was this close was 1948. Have there been any looks back at history as to increased earthquakes or increased tides or volcanism back then?
Tides we definitely get, because tides are a function of both the moon and the sun lining up, which it will do this next Sunday and Monday, because that's going to be full moon. On every full moon, you get spring tides.
Right.
When the water springs out at you. And as for earthquakes, there's been studies that show a statistically small but real increase in earthquakes at that time also.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting to look back at 1948, that particular night, and see if there were any big ones around the world. Our guest is Bob Berman, and his most recent book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death. And the number here is 800-348-2551. Let's go over to Colin in Boysville. Colin, you're on.
Hey, I told your screener that I was going to probably sound like a lunatic with this phone call.
Oh, fair enough. But welcome to the club.
Well, thank you. Something happened to me a couple of months ago. It was on a Thursday, which was, from what I heard, supposed to be the height of the Perseid meteor shower.
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving down a road with no car in front of me, no car behind me, no overhanging trees, no anything. And something slammed into my car and left 2 points of impact. It almost went right through the hood of the car.
Huh.
And I'm just kind of wondering if Bob thinks it's possible that I got hit by a meteor.
What say you, Bob?
Well, you could have been hit by a meteor, not a Perseid, though, because a Perseid meteor shower are all fragments of a particular comet named Swift-Tuttle. And comet debris are ices, and they're fragile. They're skimpy stuff that never survived the passage through Earth's atmosphere and those super high temperatures. So they don't leave any fragments that could hit your car or anything else. But every hour, especially if it was between midnight and dawn, you probably weren't out in the wee hours, but especially during those hours.
It was in the afternoon, actually.
Mm, well, there are 6 meteors per hour that are called sporadics that are not part of the meteor shower, and those generally are asteroid fragments, and those could make it all the way to the ground. Some are occasionally found as meteorites, although only 12 have been found in New York State in all of its history.
Only 12?
Yes.
In all this time?
In all these centuries,
but
yes.
One did hit a lady's car in Westchester, right?
That's right. In Peekskill, that was on October 9th, 1992. A young woman, a 20-year-old, Michelle Knapp, had her car, the trunk in that case, demolished by a meteorite. Yes, exactly right, Ray. She kept it for a while, and then she offered it for sale. And a collector offered her, and she accepted it, $69,000.
Oh, boy.
For the meteorite and also for that 10-year-old Malibu of hers, which she said, sure, take it.
Well, that's worth it. Yeah. Well, there you go. So maybe, Colin, go look for the debris of the meteor.
What kind of car are you driving? And I pulled over as soon as it happened, and I looked up to see if there was an airplane above me, you know, like if maybe something had fallen
Yeah.
From the sky, from an airplane. Anyway.
Well, so that's Colin, let me ask you a question. If you saw puncture marks on the hood.
Oh, they're there.
Did it go all the way through the hood?
No. There's two points of impact that are about 2 inches apart, and then a crease in my, it didn't break my windshield, but it hit the windshield and made a, I'm actually touching the windshield right now. I mean, it was a crease in the glass, but it didn't break the glass.
Wow.
Well, you know, in science, we usually use Occam's razor, which is the most likely, simplest explanations are usually the correct ones. So considering that there's all sorts of things that can hit a car, stray gravel, vandals, throwing stones.
Again, no cars in front of me, no cars behind me, no airplanes in the sky.
Well, it's a good...
Were you going under an overpass?
No.
Fascinating.
No, and there were no overhanging trees. There was nothing.
Have you checked your car for radiation?
No.
All right. Well, I'd get a Geiger counter on that right away. What kind of car do you drive, Colin?
It's a Toyota Matrix.
Okay. What year?
2004.
It's an 2004. Okay. Well, I think that if you could find the piece of the meteor, you could get a decent value for that.
All right, fair enough. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, man. We appreciate it. Well, there you go. A very interesting call to start the show.
Yeah.
It's downhill from here. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. It is Vox Pop. It is astronomy. And who knows where we will go from here, except to underwriting, of course.
Support comes from George Heigl Cowan's representative, available for estate, trust, and full collection evaluations and consultations in the Capital Region. 518-396-7974. Saratoga Chamber Players, bringing musicians together from Europe, Asia, Canada, and the U.S. since 1987, with a quintet concert on November 6th at 3 p.m. Skidmore College, Filene Hall, saratogachamberplayers.org. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts. AmherstCopy.com. Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com. And Colby Attorney's Service, corporate formations, document retrieval service, court filing and legal publishing for the legal and professional community since 1939. ColbyService.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you on a Thursday afternoon. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob's most recent book is Beyond Biocentrism, Rethinking Space-Time Consciousness and the Illusion of Death. Bob, you wrote one in an article in a local paper about local realism.
Yeah, it ties in because it wasn't too long ago, even in Einstein's early days, that he insisted on local realism, which simply means that there's an actual universe out there independent of our measurement of it. Sounds reasonable.
Absolutely.
That we can measure objects and how they move, but they're really there to measure. Whereas quantum mechanics started to say that nothing is there until it's observed. And John Wheeler, great physicist, just recently passed away, said that no phenomenon is a real phenomenon until it's an observed phenomenon. So that made Einstein and his buddies say, now hold on a second, this is increasingly weird, to the point where he and two buddies, Nathan Rosen and Podolsky, I forgot his first name, the three of them, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, EPR, lent their initials to what are now regarded as entangled twins, entangled particles, that are commonly called EPR correlations. In other words, quantum theory says that two, let's say, bits of matter that are created together or bits of light that are created together fly off, have seemingly independent lives, but if you measure one, then whatever qualities you see in that one just came into being upon your measurement, and that distant twin suddenly adopts properties that are the converse of the first one. In other words, if you see the first particle spinning in a horizontal way, the second particle, even if it's halfway across the universe, will instantaneously collapse. We say its wave function collapses to be a particle with the complementary spin. Or if it's light that has a polarization that's vertical, the other one will have light that a polarization that's horizontal. Einstein and his friend said, forget it. That's crazy. That would mean that the experiment was contaminated. That flies in the face of local realism, meaning that there's really an independent universe. But all the evidence since then, especially that came in 1999 and 2001, has shown that Einstein was wrong and that indeed our observations determine the things we see. In other words, our minds are somehow interwoven with nature. Which
local surrealism.
It's very far out stuff.
Interesting. Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551. Bob in Florida. Bob, New York, that is. Bob, you're on.
Okay, great. Here's something else about Einstein that has been bothering me for many years. It's not quite as far out as what you were just talking about. I'm sitting on my back porch, and I'm barbecuing in the summertime, and I'm looking over the barbecue, and I see, you know, diffraction of the landscape behind me. The way it's waving around, the heat is bending the light, right? It definitely interacts with the light. Now, when Einstein first set up, you know, his theories, they went and the astronomers verified it by looking at a eclipse of the sun and the stars behind it, and they said that if his theory was wrong, they would see the stars where they usually are, but if his theory was right, it would bend the light. But how did they take into account the heat of the sun, the fact that the sun is a sphere and around it is an atmosphere, and wouldn't that itself affect, you know, like a lens, wouldn't that bend the light?
Well, you're talking about gravitational lensing, right?
Yes.
And what you saw by your barbecue was not that.
Correct.
No, I know, but it was the heat affecting the light, and I'm projecting it onto the sun. Wouldn't there be a similar effect without the gravitational lensing? I mean, did they account for the idea that this hot circle of gases, you know, would also affect the independent proof of this experience, but this always bothered me.
Well,
anybody address it.
Well, the thing you're observing is the light traveling through air, and light doesn't go through its famous speed when it goes through air anyway. Light travels at 186,282.38 miles per second only in the vacuum of space. So when you're watching things around the barbecue, you're seeing air. And light has a different speed through different temperatures of air because different air has different densities. Denser air, like colder air.
There is an atmosphere around the sun. There's a solar atmosphere. The very hot gas.
Yeah, the immediate vicinity of the sun is very short compared to the sun's distance from us. But yeah, all of that's factored in. And anyway, the stars that we were seeing were stars in Taurus, the Bull, stars in the Hyades cluster that were all 165 light years away.
Okay.
So we're really observing stars that are 165 light years away along the edge of the sun, which is only 8 light minutes away, and whose atmosphere is only hugging it. So yeah, that wasn't a factor there. The shift was separate from that.
Okay.
That can be ignored, then, you're saying? No.
Yeah, it was all factored in. And by the way, I should add that it was a very, very difficult measurement because the stars were only being observed through a 4-inch telescope. They were not high in the sky. It was a blurry measurement anyway because, as you say, the sun makes our atmosphere crazy when you're looking at any object behind it, even though the sun was eclipsed at the time. That was in May of 1919. For that eclipse.
Yeah, the first measurement. The first guy who tried to do it, it was going to say it wasn't happening, right? It was so hard.
It was a very difficult measurement, and they sort of almost gave that to Einstein by saying, "Yes, it's been proven, it's been nailed," because it was such a blurry and difficult measurement. So you're right about that, but all those other factors were figured in. And we now say, yeah, Einstein was right, that his predictions were right.
All right. Well, we thank you for that call. And Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go over to Bill in Rosendale. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Hi, you guys. This may be too philosophical a question,
oh,
but
boy.
Bob, you seem to have a foot in philosophy anyway, at least half a foot. So the question is, why is there something rather than nothing?
Why is there something rather than nothing?
Why is there a unit? Why is there anything?
I don't know. I'm not too big on the why aspects of it, but you know, you could back up all the way to the ancient Greeks who hated the idea of nothing. It's more like, how could there ever be nothing? Remember, all the classical Greek thinkers were saying you can't have nothing. Which back when I was teaching this stuff in college, we assumed the Greeks were overthinking everything and that they were being silly, because sure, you can evacuate all the gas out of a bell jar and have a vacuum. The Greeks were saying there can't be nothing, kind of semantically, because if you're saying there is no such thing, that there is nothing, it contradicts itself, because is...
Yeah, I know. There's a grammatical problem.
Yeah. And is nothing...
Even a vacuum wouldn't be nothing. It would be a vacuum, in a way.
Yes, but it turns out that even a vacuum has energy going through it. We've got heat from the surrounding building, heat from the universe, the 2.73 degrees background CMB from the creation of the Big Bang. There's all sorts of energy going through that glass jar. So even if the atoms are evacuated from it, there's energy, and energy and mass have equivalency. So you never can have nothing. So it turns out the Greeks were right. You just can't have nothing, but not for the reasons that they were protesting.
And Billy Preston clearly wrong. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing, but obviously there can't be nothing. So poor Billy. Let's go to Chris in Saugerties. Chris, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon. My question for Bob is, on TV shows, they always change the factor of how many stars are in the Milky Way galaxy from 100 billion to 400 billion. I was just trying to get an answer as to, is it the now, are we up to 400 billion suns in just the Milky Way?
That's the figure that I like to use. And I've also seen separate published figures ranging from about 100 billion all the way up to closer to a trillion. That is 1,000 billion. But I think 400 billion probably has the ballpark pretty close. Remember, we only observe a tiny fraction of that. And
looking through the edge.
That's right. So all of these are done from counts of deep plates multiplied by the number of square degrees in the sky, which I could have told you at one time, but can't
you're
right
slipping.
Now.
So that brings me to the second part of the question. With us now upping the number, does the mass of the galaxy change with it? In other words, if we say that only 4% of the known universe is luminous matter and the rest is dark energy, dark matter, has the numbers changed? Have we gotten more you know where I'm going with that?
Yes, I do. The mass of the Milky Way has changed a little bit. For example, we now say that the Andromeda galaxy is larger than ours, but has less mass than the Milky Way.
Hmm.
And then throwing us for a loop is something that I have a feeling that you know about, which is that our rotation is strange. Given what the mass of the galaxy is, objects closer in should move at a certain rate as they go around the galactic center in the direction of Sagittarius. And stars farther away should move at a slower speed, and stars near the edge should move at a slower speed, analogous to our solar system, where Mercury travels at a faster speed, about 30 miles per second, as it goes around the sun, and Pluto, it's down to closer to 1 mile per second. But instead, our galaxy doesn't do that. It all rotates at the same rate, as if it were a solid vinyl record. So that would have given us a clue that the mass is wrong, except that that's not what we observe. So now we think it's dark matter that's throwing the whole thing off. And then the other thing is, we watch other galaxies near us. For example, in the local group, how do they interact with our galaxy? That's a really good clue to our overall mass, because if our mass is greater, we'd see these other galaxies moving at a faster speed as they twirl around us, reacting to our mass. So that's that also shows us that there's six times more stuff with gravity than everything we can observe.
Mm.
So what you're bringing up is a really deep mystery, whereas no matter where we look, within our galaxy or outside our galaxy, we're seeing far more gravity and objects reacting to that gravity than can be explained by the number of stars that you're talking about, including putative black holes, planets, nebulae, anything else we can think of. So there's something crazy going on that's one of two things. Either there is an unseen entity in the universe, including right here in our Milky Way, that has a gravitation, a strong gravitational pull, but is totally invisible. And that's, you know, hypothesized to maybe be subatomic particles that we don't know about that have a lot of mass, WIMPs, in other words, they're called. Or it could be that we're undercounting something else, that there's lots of baseballs out there,
yeah,
or Jupiter-sized planets. Every one of those offers problems, however, because we could say, well, if there were more black holes, we'd see the local reactions to those black holes,
yeah,
from the stars in their vicinity, and we're not seeing that. So they can't be local black holes supplying that missing mass. But there is missing mass. So no matter how we count the stars in our galaxy, there's something that's very screwy going on. One solution might be that gravity itself, as you get further and further from an object with gravity, instead of the gravity continuing to fall off at the same rate, which is inversely with the square of distance, the gravitational pull starts falling off more and more gently than we ever suspected with greater distance. And if that's true, if gravity itself exhibits strange characteristics at weak levels, then you don't even need dark matter to explain it, and then the whole mystery goes away and can be explained just by gravity acting differently from the way we've always assumed. That's the MOND, M-O-N-D theory.
Where do we stand with that? Have they done any models to test that?
Neither ray has been disqualified. There's some evidence that MOND may be right and that it is weird gravity causing it, and then there's other observational studies that show, no, MOND can't explain it. Mm. And MOND explains things better within our galaxy, but dark matter explains things better when we look at the interactions between galaxies. So no one model has given us satisfaction to date. And so it's still an open question.
Bob Berman is our guest. Chris, thanks for that call. The number is 800-348-2551. Let's go to Patty on the thruway. Hello, Patty, you're on.
Hi there. How are you? Thank you for taking the call.
Sure thing.
So I was driving from Newburgh to New Paltz and with a friend, and I saw this white, we both did, so this white perfect ball of something dropping out of the sky ahead of us. It had a tail. It was bright, bright white, and around the very edges, you could see faint colors like green and pink and blue, and it was beautiful and terrifying. It was so large, we had no idea what we were looking at, to the point that I eventually pulled over and called my home to make sure everything was okay. And eventually, I found a website where you can report these types of sightings. A scientist emailed me and told me that what I saw was called a fireball.
Quite so, yes.
And then there's a map where all of these things get logged. And based on the loggings of other people that saw this, I could tell that this thing fell between, I would say, Kingston and Albany.
Hmm.
What is a fireball? How are they formed? Where do they come from? And what happens when they hit the Earth?
I love it.
Yes. Well, fortunately, most of them don't hit the Earth. And a fireball can be a bit of a comet. It can be debris of an asteroid. It could be a small asteroid itself. The word fireball doesn't tell us what it is. It just tells us that it's some sort of meteor. And meteor is a generic term for anything that's tearing through our atmosphere at such a high speed that we're seeing it burn up into dust, really.
So in other words, it could be space junk, too.
Could be space junk. Could be debris from a falling-in rocket that was used for launching that's finally met its end and is finally now spiraling into the atmosphere and burning up. It could be any of those things. But it has to be a certain brightness to be a fireball. And the fact that you could see it easily in the daytime, that qualifies.
No, it was actually nighttime.
It was about
9:15 p.m.
Okay, then let me ask you, here's a key question that I have for you. Would you say, was it bright enough to cast shadows during the brief time that you saw it?
That's an excellent question. I'm not that good of an observer. But it was, if you know when you see your average shooting star, this thing was humongous. It was like a small moon. It was so large. It was awesome and terrifying. Mm. We had no idea what we were looking at.
Let me ask you a question, Patty. When you went to this website, did it show multiple sightings from around the region?
Yes. Oh. Yes, it did. And that is, if you look at the sightings, for example, it asks you all kinds of questions. How many degrees above the horizon? Did you see it coming from top right to bottom left or from top to bottom, or what did you see? And I saw it coming from top right to bottom left, but then it veers straight down. And then I started looking at the other comments, and a lot of people near me described top right to bottom left, but then around Albany, they were saying top left to bottom right.
Sure, because they were looking in a different direction.
Viewing it exactly. And some of the people said it was coming straight down as they were looking south. So that thing fell, I'm gathering, somewhere between, I don't know, like Kingston or Saugerties and Albany. And I was just wondering, what happens when that thing hits the ground? It was so magnificent and large and frightening.
It was obviously very high up, or else they wouldn't have seen it in Albany and Kingston.
And
so
it's
it
very
may
good
not have hit the ground.
It's very good that you reported it, because it's these multiple sightings that let triangulation take place and let us really see where it really was in three-dimensional space. So it was very good that you did that report. As to where it hit the ground, believe it or not, most actually burn up to dust and never hit the ground. If they do hit the ground, the average speed of impact, you're not going to believe this, but it's lower than you might think. Even though coming into the atmosphere, typically it'll be moving 30 miles a second and at least 20 miles per second. That's a very high speed.
Yes.
By the time it's slowed down by the passage through the atmosphere, they almost never glow anymore when they're below about 50 miles, even though it looks to observers like to you. Often observers will say, I saw it come down in the neighbor's yard.
Yeah.
So people see it very low, but actually they usually stop glowing just because they've slowed up so much by the atmosphere at about 50 miles or even 60 miles of a height. And then from there on in, they continue to fall unseen, slower and slower, and typically hit the ground at about 250 miles an hour,
wow,
which is fast enough to penetrate a roof and sometimes one additional story, but not fast enough to leave a crater the way you might imagine that there'd be a giant crater on the ground. So, for example, one came in and hit a house in Chicago a few years ago, smashed into a teenager's room, broke the mirror in the room. A house in Wethersfield, Connecticut was struck in 1982, and another one in that area in 1971. And in all those cases, the object penetrated a roof and went through a ceiling of the house and then was stopped by the next floor, bounced around a little bit, and then was actually discovered by the person in the house. So that's
so
very cool.
Bob Berman is our guest. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Department of Theater Arts at SUNY New Paltz, an undergraduate theater program in liberal arts with concentrations in design and technology, theater studies, and performance. newpaltz.edu/theatre. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. collegestreetmotors.com. Body Work Professionals, licensed massage therapists. Nick Pavaldi, advanced structural integration practitioner, proprietor. Offices in Latham and Saratoga Springs, open 7 days. Your massage and body work experts. bodyworkprofessionals.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. And the Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting The Wizards of Pop, an exhibition of original pop-up books designed by Sabuda and Reinhardt, through December 30th. ArkellMuseum.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, 2:42 on your Thursday afternoon. Bob Berman is our guest on this Astronomy Vox Pop. And, Bob, where are you headed next?
Oh, the next tours coming up are in Chile.
Oh, you're taking a tour to Chile.
Yep, in February, March. That's my favorite one that we do every year because, boy, we go to mountaintops and see the sky the way you could never see it from even anywhere in America. We go to the Atacama Desert. It's just wonderful things that we see. And then the next month in March, we're going to Central Alaska, what we do every year for the Northern Lights.
Yep.
And then next July for the total eclipse of the sun, which will be out in Wyoming. But, boy, I urge anybody who remotely can afford it, and it's not that expensive, to come to Chile or to Alaska with us, especially Chile tour, and there's still room in those.
So you're out in the high desert of Chile.
Yes.
And do you ever get bitten by a scorpion?
No.
Good?
No.
It's safe?
It's safe.
You wear boots, right?
It's perfectly safe. Okay. I don't wear boots.
No?
I wear sandals. Yeah.
You wear sandals?
Yeah, yeah.
Bob, there are things that will bite you out there. Let's go back to the phones. 800. How do people find out more about that?
Specialinteresttours.com.
Specialinteresttours.com. Bob Berman is our guest. Over to Tom in Malta. Tom, you're on.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
As a child back in the 60s, I was fortunate enough to see the Kecksburg UFO.
Oh, yeah.
That flew over Detroit and landed in Pennsylvania.
Right you are.
And it was quite an experience at that age.
You saw the thing, Tom?
Oh, yeah. It actually went over playing football in the school yard, and it went over, and me, my brother, and a couple of friends, and you could hear it, and you could see it.
Yeah.
So it was pretty intense for a nine-year-old. But I was wondering, you know, if you look this up and you watch some of the shows on it, it's pretty vague on what it was, where it came from. And I was wondering, do you have any information or beliefs on what that was?
Well, this is out of your astronomy realm, Bob, but what do you think? Do you know anything about this one?
I don't know anything about
this. Well,
this
is a good one. So the current thinking is it was space junk, probably a Soviet satellite, and because allegedly the Army came in and sort of shut everything down and took it away. It was an acorn-shaped thing that people reported.
Hmm.
It was really an interesting one. Kecksburg is a good one, Tom.
Really? The ones that I get involved with are the houses that are struck because I like talking to the people and finding out what they saw and where the meteorite ended up, and there's some great stories with those. So I follow all of those in our whole listening area. And this has been pretty much ground zero for a number of such impacts over the last 30, 40 years.
So, yes. Tom, this really isn't in Bob's sphere of expertise, but I'll just ask you quickly, where were you playing football when you saw that?
Pontiac, Michigan, in December.
Amazing. Yeah.
And like I said, you could hear it approaching, and everything stopped, and then it went right over top of the small playground that we were in, and you could see it, just flames, and it was pretty spectacular, and rushed home and told the parents, and they didn't believe us, of course, until it was in the paper the next day. And then, again, followed up a little bit back in the 60s. You couldn't Google it, but found out that it had landed in Pennsylvania in a farmer's field, or in a forest or a woodlot there.
Yep.
And then somebody came, cordoned it off, and then collected it and took it off. And that's it.
Well, now you told the story on the radio, so be ready for that knock on the door from the men in black.
Okay, I will wait for them.
Tom, thanks a lot. Interesting thing about that one, though, Bob, based on, and there were, again, it was like a meteor sighting. A lot of people over a vast area saw it. But there were a fair number of people who reported seeing it change direction.
Yes. Well, that's the way witnesses are. You know, to car crashes, air crashes, you get disparate accounts from different people. On October 9th, 1992, and we had the famous meteor over the entire Atlantic coast, and it traveled up to the northeast, and people saw it in Delaware and in Maryland and completely up the coast, and that's the one that wound up hitting, or at least a fragment of it, hit the car in Peekskill on that day. But it was widely observed before it came down.
Our guest is Bob Berman, and the number to call here is 800-348-2551. John in New Paltz is next. John.
Yeah, hi. So, Bob, in The Sun's Heartbeat, you wrote that just like it, during when our sun is just about to explode, or just before it's about to explode, that the metals inside its mass will begin to fuse, and I'm assuming also on their own produce some starlight on their way out, like before it explodes. Is that true? They fuse and produce light.
That's quite right. Now the sun, I think I also mentioned in that book that because the sun is just not massive enough, the nearest star that could do that is probably the dog star Sirius at 8.65 light years away. The sun, you need a more massive star to get the kind of pressures and temperatures in the core to produce a good, solid supernova explosion. The sun could never turn into a supernova. But that said, yes, when the sun uses up too much of its hydrogen fuel, then instead of hydrogen fusing into helium, which is what's going on right now and providing all that nice sunlight and heat, then you start to have helium fusing to produce oxygen and carbon. And by the time the sun is in its old age, we have other fusion processes. And it ends up actually being, the sun will end up being a ball the size of Earth made of mostly oxygen and carbon. Solid. It'll be a solid surface of oxygen and carbon, sort of like our breaths are all carbon dioxide. So it'll almost be like one giant solid human breath, but packed together and Earth-sized.
So this is my actual question. My question is, in the deep into the Big Whimper, in a universe starved of hydrogen, when a nebula coalesces, is there a window or models for metal nebulas made of metals coalescing and into enough mass to light up even briefly as stars?
Yes, but it doesn't start out with metals. It always starts out with hydrogen, which is logical because hydrogen is but the most common element by far. So when a nebula collapses, you'll get pockets of super collapsing balls, and those will be the stars fusing hydrogen to helium. And then there are always a minority of materials in there. You're right, metals. And all metals can fuse right up to iron, but you can't get energy from iron fusing into anything else because that takes energy to do that. So once you're down to just iron, once you've fused iron and created enough iron, you're at the end of your trail. You're at the end of the line. You're out of fuel. You can no longer create energy by that process. And so it stops. And that's when the star dies, really.
John, thank you very much. Bob Berman is our guest. And Pam in Knox has been waiting a while. Pam, you're on with Bob Berman.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
What a great show.
Thanks.
I wanted to feed into the object hitting the car from nowhere. It's happened to me twice in the last 3 to 4 months.
Wow.
I've been both times up in the area coming up toward Thatcher Park, coming up the top of the hill. It's all open, fields on either side, no trees, no vehicles of any kind on the road. And then smack, there's this something hits the windshield. And fortunately, both times it didn't crack the windshield, but I thought, well, that's odd. And then I thought, well, gee, if it was a piece of, a meteorite, an actual object, wouldn't it be hot and I would see flames or something?
No, that's a common misconception. When a meteor hits the Earth's surface, it's already cooled down to where it can be immediately picked up. Now, we know that because in Noblesville, Indiana, I believe that was also in 1992, if I remember correctly, two boys were hanging out in front of the house, two teenagers, one standing on the ground with his bicycle, holding up his bicycle, talking to a friend, and then thunk right into the lawn next to them. A meteor thunked into the lawn, and they walked over to it, and the kids picked it up, the rock up immediately, and it was barely warm to the touch, and it proved to be a real meteorite. So,
wow.
Coming through our cold atmosphere, because the air is quite cold, you know, just 10, 20, 30 miles up, this cools down that one. It starts out being very hot because of its high speed, but it cools down to be barely warm by the time it hits the ground. So let's talk about your car. So your car, reaching the same general area here in the Albany area, has been thunked more than once by
thunked more than once.
Now, was this after a relationship, the end of a relationship, or to do with that?
Really?
No. Nothing to do with your personal life. This
was
because obviously.
No. Just going to get groceries.
Okay, going to get groceries. So
no, just like as if a piece of gravel came off a gravel truck. Just and only then you'd usually see it bounce. But it smacks the windshield. And, you know, if you're not lucky, it cracks the windshield.
Well, let me ask you: is the road in that area very gravelly?
No. It's beautiful. It's just open and smooth. And I know I ask myself all those questions.
Well, I'm out of ideas.
The odds would be astronomical for two. I mean, I know you said, Bob, there was a town in Connecticut where it's happened twice in 30 years or something like that.
Yes.
But one car twice.
It wasn't in the same location. I'm just saying it was kind of up in the hill towns.
So you're a carrier.
I'm a carrier.
Yeah.
Now, do you want my serious question?
Sure.
I've been dying to ask this.
Okay.
And it has to do with how we attempt to perceive the workings of the universe. And my question is, though we seem to be doing pretty well in our own backyard, so to speak, we're actually perceiving things correctly so we can send a man to the moon and a rover to Mars and we can go visit Pluto and so on. But are we not nevertheless really bounded by the physical construct of our brains, the chemical construct of our brains? We attempt to extend our senses with using machines so that we can see further, hear further, perceive light waves that we can't normally perceive, and so on and so forth. But we're working with a brain that has a lot in common with a rat or a cat or, an elephant.
Got that right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Well, I think your question is really getting to a very, very, very deep and profound issue that many cosmologists, not to mention philosophers, have asked, which is that everything that we see and observe, we're doing so using you're using the word brain, but I would say using our awareness, our consciousness, our experience, we have to. The question is, does this influence, does this color what we see? Does this bias what we see?
Correct.
Because obviously we only perceive certain wavelengths of light. We're invisible. Some are invisible to us. Our brains work a certain way, so we tend to make certain kinds of conclusions, even though we think we're very open-minded about everything. So does our own consciousness bias what we see and introduce not a true picture of the universe? And this has been asked for centuries. For example, George Berkeley, who the college and the town were named after, used to say that the only things that we perceive are our perceptions. And so we assume that there's a universe that corresponds to our perceptions, but still our perceptions are based on the colors we can see, the kinds of conclusions we humans will make, etc. And the answer to your very deep question is, absolutely. We would love to know what is the nature of our own consciousness to see how that may be influencing what we see, whether it's introducing like a colored lens or filter to everything in the universe so we could subtract that and know what's really going on. Not to mention that quantum theory since the 1920s has been showing that our observations actually affect what we see, that the physical universe changes. They're particles rather than waves if we're watching, and they're waves if we're not watching. And so this shows that...
Does the tree make a noise when it falls in the forest?
Right.
That's right. Well, we've known for a long time that it does not. The tree cannot make a noise if we're not watching. But the fact that people still bring that up show that it's still an issue. What you're mentioning is a real is
well,
a
that
real,
was a fun call.
It's a valid issue.
Pam, thanks a lot. Very quickly, we only have a minute or so left. Robin in Albany. Robin, you're on.
Hi there. Okay, I hope you don't mind if I ask two very brief.
We only have a minute.
I have to definitional. Okay, real quick then. People always talk about dark matter. I might have missed some of Chris's call earlier, but people very rarely go back to recap exactly what they mean by that. So just to clarify, for example, is my ham sandwich dark matter?
No, definitely
not. Is it Black Forest ham?
Well, what's an overwhelmed. No, but so what I meant is, I mean, Chris referred to your caller, dark matter and luminous matter. So by dark matter, we don't just mean any old thing in space that does not emit its own light.
Well, in a way we do, because the thing is, we're seeing effects both in the way our galaxy rotates and in the way other galaxies behave with other galaxies that indicate that there's a lot more gravity out there than everything that we can see combined and theorize combined. In other words, all the stars, planets, nebulae, black holes, everything that we know is out there and think could also be out there doesn't add up to even 1/6
right.
of the gravity that we are observing all around us. And so therefore we say there must be something that is invisible but has gravity. And that's what's called dark matter.
Robin, we'll have to leave it right there. Bob Berman, thank you, sir. A wonderful job. Support comes from Mango Tree Imports, a global fair trade shop in downtown Saratoga Springs, New York, featuring artisan goods from more than 60 countries. MangoTreeImports.com and Facebook. Temple Sinai, Saratoga Springs, New York, an open congregation welcoming the Jewish community and visitors for Shabbat, holiday services, their religious school, cultural programs, and more. SaratogaSinai.org. Empire State Youth Orchestras, presenting youth orchestra in concert featuring Dvorak, Mahler, 1 and 14-year-old violinist Aram Kim this Saturday, 7:30 p.m. I got that. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, ESYO.org. And Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We could serve good farmland for good forever. AGStewardship.org. All right, Berman, good job. We'll see you next month, right? Enjoy the supermoon.
Thank you, Ray.
Have fun. And thank you all for listening. I apologize to the 9 people who we did not get to. These calls, sometimes the answers, they take a little while, and I apologize to everyone on this world and the next. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who was our engineer. Phones were answered by Deb Malik, our producer, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and we talk pickling and fermentation. I've been pickled for years, so it should work out. We'll see you tomorrow. The news is next.